ORG. Coming up on CQT is Drama Text in an hour of spoken word recordings, and we'll get to it after a little bit of station business. Till next week.
CQT
90.3 FM.
Montréal. Contre la COVID-19 est en cours, mais l'ensemble de la population n'est pas encore protégée. Même si vous êtes vacciné, vous devez continuer d'appliquer les mesures sanitaires. Portez un masque, maintenez la distanciation physique et lavez-vous les mains régulièrement. En cas de symptômes, passez un test de dépistage et respectez les consignes d'isolement. Apprenez-en davantage sur les mesures au québec.ca/coronavirus. Respectons les règles, tout le temps, sans exception. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Good evening and welcome to the May 13th edition of Dramatext. Tonight we'll be celebrating the work of Lawrence Ferlin Getty, who passed away recently at the age of 101. This is a reading that took place as part of the University of California at Berkeley's Lunchtime Poetry Series. So, without further ado, here's Lawrence Ferlin Getty.
Hello and welcome to Lunch Poems in the Morrison Library. I can just feel the excitement bubbling in the room here today. I want to thank you all for being here. And I just want to mention we do have a mailing list by the librarian's desk, and we still have 4 more readings coming up in the spring. We'll take a little break here, but we'll be back February 2nd with Saskia Hamilton, so please come back for that. And just a few things. Zach Rogo is here. He's the former Lunch Poems coordinator and one of its founders. He'll be introducing Lawrence Ferlin Getty, and Robert Hess will introduce Zach Rogo. And Zach just wanted me to there's a chain of events happening. And Zach just wanted me to mention we are very pleased that The Face of Poetry has just been published, and that features 10 years of Lunch Poems. And there are 2 readings coming up to celebrate that book. The first is on December 7th at 7:30 at Cody's, and the second is December 13th at 7 at a clean, well-lighted place for books in San Francisco. So now please join me in welcoming Robert Hess.
Thank you all for coming. We're only doing this fire brigade because I also wanted to welcome Lawrence Ferlin Getty and say how grateful I am that he's come today. And I'm going to introduce Zach Rogo, who started this series, who had the idea that it would be delicious to be able to hear poets in this room once a month. And it's now 10 years of Lunch Poems, and Zach gave us a wonderful gift, and it's commemorated partly in this new book just out, The Face of Poetry, which includes the photographs of the poets by Margaretta Mitchell, who's right here, and the book itself edited by Zach, and it's also going to be over there with Lawrence Ferlin Getty's books. Zach is a poet and a gifted translator, in addition to now being the editor of Two Lines, the best journal of translation, literary translation of the country. So please welcome him.
Thanks, Bob. It's a thrill to be here to introduce Lawrence Ferlin Getty, who was a boyhood idol of mine. And you probably know that he was a leading figure in the Beat Generation, which really rocked America in the 1950s, both socially and culturally. And he also is the co-founder of City Lights Bookstore, which I think it's fair to say is the most beloved and well-visited literary landmark in North America. And of course, the editor-in-chief of City Lights Books, which published, among other things, the book Lunch Poems by Frank O'Hara, where the series gets its name. One of the less well-known sides of Lawrence Ferlin Getty is that he's been all his life both a leader and a rebel. When he was a teenager, he was a Boy Scout, and he made Eagle Scout the same month that he was arrested for shoplifting. I'm not sure anyone else could claim that. During World War II, he was a 90-day wonder. The 90-day wonders were a group of very talented and bright young people who were enlisted basically to revitalize the Navy after the disaster of Pearl Harbor, and they were very quickly fast-tracked into highly responsible roles. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti commanded at the age of, I think, 25, a ship during the D-Day invasion of Normandy. And he also got to witness the horrors of war firsthand. He was present at Nagasaki not many weeks after the bomb was dropped there, and so I can imagine that that was very formative. he's also an accomplished painter, and his paintings have been exhibited and won prizes nationally and internationally, and I think that painting is a thread that runs throughout his poems, his love of visual art. Both as a child and as an adult, he lived for a stretch in France, and he actually has a doctoral degree from the Sorbonne, is that correct? And translated the work of the wonderful poet Jacques Prévert into English. His ninth volume of poetry, Americus, Book One, was published last year when he reached the young age of 85. And it's one of his strongest books. It won the Northern California Book Reviewers Association Award. It's a fascinating collage of memories, literary quotations with a distinctively Ferlinghetti twist, historical records, headlines, personal letters. It's I think, the most ambitious effort by an American poet to weave together all the threads of American history and world culture since the cantos of Ezra Pound. So please welcome Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
I can't possibly live up to such a beautiful introduction, full of exaggerations. Of animals dying. In a dream within a dream, I dreamt a dream of all the animals dying out, all animals everywhere dying and dying. The wild animals, the long-haired animals, winged animals, feathered animals, clawed and scaled and furry animals, rutting and dying in shrinking rainforests, in piney woods and high sierras, and shrinking prairies, tumbleweed mesas, captured, beaten, starved and stunned, cornered and traded, species not meant to be nomadic, wandering rootless as man. All the animals crying out in their hidden places, slinking away and crawling away through the last wild places, through the dense underbrush, the last great thickets, beyond the mountains, crisscrossed with switchbacks, beyond the marshes, beyond the plains and fences, in the high country, in the low country, in the bayous, crisscrossed with highways. In a dream, within a dream, I dreamt a dream of how they feed and rut and run and hide, how the seals are beaten on ice fields, the soft, white, furry seals with eggshell skulls, the great green turtles beaten and eaten, exotic birds nested and caged and tethered, rare wild beasts and strange reptiles and weird woozoos hunted down for zoos by bearded black marketeers, who afterwards ride around Singapore in German limousines with French whores. And all the animals calling to each other, calling to each other in codes we never understand. Seal and steer cry out in the same voice, the same cry. The wounds never heal. In the common wheel of animals, we steal their lives to feed our own, and with their lives, our dreams are sown. In a dream within a dream I saw how the bed breath of machines sickens earth and man, and bottom line capitalism masquerading as democracy rapes earth and man. But in a dream I dreamt a dream of how all the watershed people of the earth, all the ethnic peoples of the earth, all the disenfranched people of the world, the mom and pop people of America, the youth of America, and the poor of America would at last rise up and dismantle industrial civilization without killing anybody and save mankind from itself. Like a medieval monk trying to read by candlelight up here. This is a recital of more or less random choice of favorite poems and some recent ones. The very first poem when I came to San Francisco, 1951, from a rooftop in North Beach. It's the first poem in my first book, Pictures of the Gone World. This thing is trying to get comfortable up here. Away above a harborful of caulkless houses, among the Charlie Noble chimney pots of a rooftop rigged with clotheslines, a woman pastes up sails upon the wind, hanging out her morning sheets with wooden pins. Her nearly naked breasts throw taut shadows when she stretches up to hang at last the last of her so whitewashed sins. But it is wetly amorous and winds itself about her, clinging to her skin. So caught, with arms upraised, she tosses back her head in voiceless laughter, and in choiceless gesture then shakes out gold hair, while in the reachless seascape spaces between the blown white shrouds stand out the bright steamers to kingdom come. Heaven was only half as far that night at the poetry recital, listening to the burnt phrases, when I heard the poet have a rhyming erection, then look away with a lost look. Every animal, he said at last, after intercourse is sad, but the back row lovers
looked oblivious and glad. Reading Yeats, I do not think of Ireland, but of midsummer New York, and of myself back then, reading that copy I found on the Third Avenue L, the L with its fly-hung fans and its signs reading, spitting is forbidden, the L careening through its third-story world with its third-story people in their third-story doors, looking as if they had never heard of the ground. An old dame watering her plant, or a joker in a straw, putting a stick pin in his peppermint tie, and looking just like he had nowhere to go but Coney Island. Or an undershirted guy rocking in his rocker, watching the L pass by, as if he expected it to be different each time. Reading Yeats, I do not think of Arcady, and of its woods, which Yeats thought dead. I think instead of all the gaunt faces getting off at Midtown places with their hats and their jobs, and of that lost book I had with its blue cover and its white inside, where a pencil hand had written, "Horsemen pass by." There should be some silence between poems. Like at a picture at an exhibition. Pictures at an exhibition have to have some space between them. But I have just 40 minutes, so I don't want to waste too much time on silence. This is the first poem in a Coney Island of the Mind. Francisco Goya. In Goya's greatest scenes, we seem to see the people of the world exactly at the moment when they first attain the title of suffering humanity. They writhe upon the page in a veritable rage of adversity, heaped up, groaning with babies and bayonets under cement skies in an abstract landscape of blasted trees, bent statues, bat swings and beaks, slippery gibbets, cadavers and carnivorous cocks, and all the final hollering monsters of the imagination of disaster. They are so bloody real, it is as if they really still existed. And they do. Only the landscape is changed. We still are ranged along the roads, plagued by legionnaires, false windmills, and demented roosters. We are the same people, only further from home, on freeways 50 lanes wide, on a concrete continent spaced with bland billboards illustrating imbecile illusions of happiness. The scene shows fewer tumbrils, but more spaced-out citizens in painted cars, and they have strange license plates and engines that devour America. A few more from Coney Island of the Mind. See, it was like this. When we waltz into this place, a couple of far-out cats is doing an Aztec two-step. And I says, "Dad, let's cut." But then this dame comes up behind me, see, and says, "You and me could really exist." "Wow," I says. Only the next day, she has bad teeth and really hates poetry. Don't let that horse, "Eat that violin," cried Chagall's mother. But he kept right on painting and became famous and kept on painting the horse with violin in mouth. And when he finally finished it, he jumped up upon the horse and rode away, waving the violin. And then, with a low bow, gave it to the first naked nude he ran across, and there were no strings attached. The penny candy store beyond the L is where I first fell in love with unreality. Jelly beans glowed in the semi-gloom of that September afternoon. A cat upon the counter moved among the licorice sticks and Tootsie Rolls and oh boy gum. Outside, the leaves were falling as they died. A wind had blown away the sun. A girl ran in. Her hair was rainy. Her breasts were breathless in the little room. Outside, the leaves were falling, and they cried, "Too soon, too soon." Constantly risking absurdity and death, whenever he performs above the heads of his audience, the poet, like an acrobat, climbs on rhyme to a high wire of his own making, and balancing on I-beams above a sea of faces, paces his way to the other side of day, performing entre-shots and sleight-of-foot tricks and other high theatrics, and all without mistaking anything for what it may not be, for he's the super-realist who must perforce perceive taught truth before the taking of each stance or step in his supposed advance toward that still higher perch where beauty stands and waits with gravity to start her death-defying leap. And he, a little Charlie Chaplin man, who may or may not catch her fair eternal form spread-eagled in the empty air of existence. Here's a few Big Sur poems in Bixby Canyon. A vast confusion. Long, long I lay in the sands. Sound of trains in the surf, in subways of the sea. And an even greater undersound of a vast confusion in the universe, a rumbling and a roaring, as if some enormous creature turning under sea and earth, a billion sotto voices murmuring, a vast muttering, a swelling, stuttering in ocean speakers, world's voice box, heard with ear to sand, a shocked echoing, a shocking shouting of all life's voices lost in night, and the tape of it somehow running backwards now through the Moog synthesizer of time and sea, chaos unscrambled back to the first harmonies and the first light. Lamp blocks the view of part of the audience. I'd like to see you as well as you'd like to see me. But hello there. This poem I owe to Kenneth Rexroth, a poem poem of his called Lyell's Hypothesis. Some of you may see the connection. But the two candidates that were here in San Francisco when I arrived in the 50s were really the kings of the poetry scene. They were the pater familia of the San Francisco poets at that time, Kenneth Rexroth and Kenneth Patchen. Patchen was living in North Beach at that time. Both Kenneths are unjustly ignored today. Especially Rexroth had an enormous influence on all the San Francisco poets at that time, especially Gary Snyder. Rexroth's Mountain Poems, direct line to Gary's. This is instead of Lyell's Hypothesis, this is Olber's Paradox, Bixby Canyon. And I heard the learned astronomer, whose name was Heinrich Olbers, speaking to us across the centuries about how he observed with naked eye how in the sky there were some few stars close up, and the further away he looked, the more of them there were, with infinite numbers of clusters of stars in myriad Milky Ways and myriad nebulae, so that from this we may deduce that in the infinite distances there must be a place, there must be a place where all is light, and that the light from that high place where all is light simply hasn't got here yet, which is why we still have night. But when at last that light arrives, when at last it does get here, the part of day we now call night will have a white sky with little black dots in it, little black holes where once were stars. And then in that symbolic, so poetic place which will be ours, we'll be our own true shadows and our own illumination on a sunset earth. Learned professors are still publishing books trying to explain why we have night, or why do we have darkness at night. There still isn't a good explanation. Maybe there's some learned astronomers here who can enlighten me, us. Another Big Sur poem. Night's black mirror is broken. The star crab has scuttled away with the inkwell from into India. Dawn sows its mustard seed. In the steep ravines and gulches of Big Sur, small animals stir under the tough underbrush. As sun creeps down the canyon walls into the narrow meadows where the wild quail run and cluck, daytime moon, after much reflection, says, "Sun is God." And the stream, standing still, rushes forward. Deep chess. Life itself like championship chess. Dark players jousting on a checkered field, where you have only so much time to complete your moves and your clock running all the time. And if you take too much time for one move, you have much less for the rest of your life. And your opponent, dark or fair, begging, bugging you with his deep eyes, or obscenely wiggling his crazy eyebrows, or blowing smoke in your face, or crossing and recrossing his legs or her legs, or otherwise screwing around and acting like some insolent, invulnerable, unbeatable god who can read your mind and heart. And one hasty move may ruin you, for you must play deep chess, like the one deep game Spassky won from Fischer. And if your unstudied opening was not too brilliant, you must play to win, not draw. And suddenly come up with a new Nabokov variation. And then lay him out at last with some super endgame no one has ever even dreamed of. And there's still time. Your move. One of my more and more infrequent visits to New York. Queens Cemetery, setting sun. Airport bus from JFK, cruising through Queens, passing huge endless cemeteries. By Long Island's old expressway, once a dirt path for wheelless Indians, myriad small tombstones tilted up, gesturing statues on parapets, stone arms or wings upraised, lost among illegible inscriptions, and the setting yellow sun painting all of them on one side only with an ochre brush, rows and rows and rows of small stone slabs tilted toward the sun forever, while on the far horizon, Manhattan's great stone slabs, skyscraper tombs and parapets, casting their own long black shadows over these long-haired graves, the final resting places, the final restless places of old country potato farmers, dustbin pawnbrokers, dead Dagos and Dublin bouncers, tinsmiths and blacksmiths and roofers, house painters and house carpenters, cabinet makers and cigar makers, garment workers and streetcar motormen, railroad switchmen and signal salesmen, swabbers and sweepers and swampers, steam fitters and key punch operators, ward healers and labor organizers, railroad dicks and small-time mafiosi, shopkeepers and saloon keepers and doormen. Icemen and middlemen and con men. Housekeepers and housewives and dowagers, French housemaids and Swedish cooks, Brooklyn barmaids and Bronxville butlers, opera singers and Gandhi dancers, pitchers and catchers in the days of ragtime baseball, pool room hustlers and fight promoters, Catholic sisters of charity, parish priests and Irish cops, Viennese doctors of delirium, now all abandoned in eternity. Parcels in a dead letter office, inscrutable addresses on them, beyond further deliverance. In an America wheeling past them and disappearing oblivious into East River's echoing tunnels down the great American drain. I was in Spoleto in the 70s during Ezra Pound's silent period, and this is a report I sent back to the old Saturday Review. Pound at Spoleto. I walked into a loge in the Teatro Melliso, the lovely Renaissance salle, where the poetry readings and the chamber concerts were held every day of the Spoleto Festival, and suddenly saw Ezra Pound for the first time, still as a mandarin statue in a box in a balcony at the back of the theater, one tier up from the stalls. It was a shock. Seeing only a striking old man in curious pose, thin and long-haired, aquiline at 80, head tilted strangely to one side, lost in permanent abstraction. After three young poets on stage, he was scheduled to read from his box, and there he sat with an old friend who held his papers, waiting. He regarded the knuckles of his hands, moving them a very little, expressionless. Only once, when everyone else in the full theater applauded someone on stage, did he rouse himself to clap without looking up, as if stimulated by a sound in a void. After almost an hour, his turn came, or after a life. Everyone in the hall rose, turned and looked back and up at Pound in his booth, applauding. The applause was prolonged, and Pound tried to rise from his armchair. A microphone was partly in the way. He grasped the arms of the chair with his bony hands and tried to rise. He could not, and he tried again, and could not, and tried again, and could not. His old friend did not try to help him. Finally, she put a poem in his hand, and after at least a minute, his voice came out. First the jaw moved, and then the voice came out inaudible. A young Italian pulled the mic up very close to his face and held it there, and the voice came over. Frail but stubborn, higher than I had expected, a thin, soft monotone. The hall had gone silent at a stroke. The voice knocked me down. So soft, so thin, so frail, so stubborn still. I put my head on my arms, on the velvet sill of the box. I was surprised to see a single tear drop on my knee. The thin, indomitable voice went on. I went blind from the box, through the back door of it, into the empty corridor of the theater, where they still sat turned to him, went down and out into the sunlight, weeping. Up above the howl, up above the town, by the ancient aqueduct, the chestnut trees were still in bloom. Mute birds flew in the valley below. The sun shone on the chestnut trees, and the leaves turned in the sun, and turned, and turned, and turned, and would continue turning. His voice went on and on through the leaves. This is a very short passage from the first. I don't want to use the word canto. The first part of Americas, my most recent book. To summarize the past by theft and illusion, with a parasong, a palimpsest, a manuscript writ over, a graph of consciousness at best, a consciousness of felt life, a rushing together of the raisins of wrath of living and dying, the laughter and forgetting, the maze and amaze of life, sound of the eternal dialogue echoing through the centuries of all the voices that ever sang or wrote, bearers of our consciousness, and the flux of history interrupted by catastrophes, flowers blooming out of season, sound of weeping beyond reason, a pianist playing in the ruins of Prague, a London fog, a cow, a clod at a country crossing, dark dawn and a rooster's cry, kick-kitty-kee, a light that ever was on land and sea, and tea at Rumpelmeyer's in the Rue Rivoli, the labyrinth on the floor of Chartres Cathedral, and a Warsaw concerto heard distantly on a Detroit mall full of gumball goombas on roller skates, cry of a black singer in a beat-up Harlem bar, a bat hitting a ball in the first game of a new season, laughter in a eucalyptus forest. In a smiling summer dream, and fool's gold gleaming in a California stream. All the images of the splendid life of the world, down the rivers of windfall light, a trillion, trillion images, kaleidoscopic in a psychedelic tropic, later boiled down to a seminar topic, a song resung by a bird flown over to another zone, another climate, primate mutated into many colors wrought from the dark in his mother long ago, from the dark of ancient Europa, Euro man and Euro woman, in the hold of a listing freighter with Americus in the womb, born by the Hudson and Grant's tomb. He was an American. He was an American boy. He read the American Boy magazine and became a Boy Scout in the suburbs. He thought he was Tom Sawyer, catching crayfish in the Bronx River and imagining the Mississippi. He had a baseball mitt and an American Flyer bike. He delivered the Woman's Home Companion at 5 in the afternoon or the Herald Trib at 5 in the morning. It was long since he was a herdsman. I hope this is the right CD. Wrong. This is the last poem I'm going to do because time is practically up. Inasmuch as President Bush saw fit to use the disaster of 9/11 as an excuse to start the Third World War, that is, the war with the Third World, I wrote this poem. History of the airplane. Brothers said they thought they had invented something that could make peace on earth if the wrong brothers didn't get hold of it. When their wonderful flying machine took off at Kitty Hawk into the kingdom of birds, but the parliament of birds was freaked out by this man-made bird and fled to heaven. The famous Spirit of St. Louis took off eastward and flew across the big pond with Lindy at the controls in his leather helmet and goggles, hoping to sight the doves of peace, but he did not. even though he circled Versailles. And then, the famous Yankee Clipper took off in the opposite direction and flew across the terrific Pacific. But the Pacific doves were frighted by this strange amphibious bird and hid in the Orient sky. And then, the famous Flying Fortress took off, bristling with guns and testosterone, to make the world safe for peace and capitalism. But the birds of peace were nowhere to be found before or after Hiroshima. And so then clever men built bigger and faster flying machines. And these great man-made birds with jet plumage flew higher than any real birds and seemed about to fly into the sun and melt their wings and, like Icarus, crash to earth. And the Wright brothers were long forgotten in the high-flying bombers that now began to visit their blessings on various third worlds. All the while claiming they were searching for doves of peace. And they kept flying and flying until they flew right into the 21st century. And then, one fine day, a third world struck back and stormed the great plains and flew them straight into the beating heart of skyscraper America, where there were no aviaries and no parliaments of doves. And in a blinding flash, America became a part of the scorched earth of the world. Of ashes blew across the land, and for one long moment in eternity there is chaos and despair, and buried loves and voices, cries and whispers fill the air everywhere.
Well, you're listening to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. This is Dromotext. We'll hear once a week on Thursday with the spoken word from 8 to 9 p.m. And we just listened to an extended reading by the late Lawrence Ferlinghetti. And we'll continue out the show with another reading by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who passed away at the age of 101 last week. So, till next week, when we'll be back with more poetry for your listening enjoyment.
Where is Vietnam? Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the then president, also known as Colonel Corn Pone, got out a blank army draft and began to fill in the spaces with men. And Colonel Corn Pone got down to the bottom of the order, where there is a space to indicate just where the troops are to be sent, and Colonel Corn Pone got a faraway look in his eye and reached out and started spinning a globe of the world. And his eye wandered over the spinning surface of the world, and after a long time he said, "I see no relief." So they brought him a relief map of the world. And he looked at it a long time and said, "Thank you, gentlemen. I see it all very clearly now. Yes, indeed. Everything stands out very clearly now. And I can see the oceans themselves rolling back and Western civilization still marching westward around the world. And the new frontier now truly knows no boundaries. And those there Vietnamese don't stand a Chinaman's chance in hell. But still, it's all these Chinamen who think they do, and also think they can actually reverse the westward march of civilization and actually reverse the natural westward spin of our globe. But, gentlemen, these are not war games. This is not space angels. This is the real thing, gentlemen. And I know right exactly where this here Vietnam is, gentlemen, and I want to make doubly sure that all our own people know right exactly where this here Vietnam is, gentlemen, in case any of you should happen to get cornered by some eggheads or someone." And just then, Lady Bird came running, and Colonel Corn Pone stepped into the cloakroom and whispered to her, "The world really does rotate westward, don't it?" And she, being smarter than he, as is usually the case, whispered back that this here Vietnam was not a place but a state of mind. And Colonel Corn Pone got that old faraway look again and stepped back onto the front porch where they keep the rockers and sat there rocking for a long time and then said, "Gentlemen, I'm a family man and this is for real. And I'm hereby ordering the complete and final liberation of Vietnam. For the roots of the trouble are found wherever the landless and oppressed, the poor and despised, stand before the gates of opportunity and are not allowed across into the great society which seems to lie out before me like a land of dreams. And so, gentlemen, here we go. Fasten your seat belts. We are powerful and free and united. There ain't much we can do. And so, gentlemen, let me point out to you exactly where it is we all are going on this here globe, because, gentlemen, even though I am reputed never to have been out of the United States, I do know right where we are going on the brink of Vietnam. And even though we don't want to stop the world spinning in the right direction, even for an instant, I do want to slow it down just long enough for me to put my finger for you right on this here sore spot, which is Vietnam. And Colonel Corn Pone put out his hand to slow down the world just a bit. But this world would not be slowed down a bit. This world would not stop spinning at all. And Texas and Vietnam spun on together faster and faster, slipping away under Colonel Corn Pone's hand, because the surface of this world had suddenly become very, very slippery with a strange kind of red liquid that ran on it across all the obscene boundaries. And this world went on spinning faster and faster in the same so predestined direction, and kept on spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. parade tirade. Good night, ladies, and good night, nuns and priests and monks who never march in peace parades. Protestants shouldn't protest. The holy wars are over. The only united crusade, a fund drive. And good night, holy ministers who evict peace groups from their premises, onward Christian soldiers. And good night, good gray soldier, and good night, sweet Prince Kennedy. As long as there are guns, they will speak telescopically. And good night, Colonel Cornpone, and good night, sad cop who turned the hoses on a whole generation and flipped later. And good night, asinine Armistice Day parades that nobody under 40 believes in. Don't laugh. You should take them seriously. Those big phony scenes which have nothing to do with us and the way we want to live. The America of the American Legion isn't ours. This ain't 1919. Let them march off a cliff somewhere with their obscene sidearms and sinister slogans. Call out the horse Marines and clean up the mess. I didn't know they piled it that high. You won't get us to run your errands anymore, but here comes the band anyway. A catch in the throat, a Lady Liberty on a float. God save our country's flag, she said. And God knows veterans love wars. Their eyes have seen the glory. When old comrades get together, like in the good old days. So sweep away the pickets. And good day to you, Dr. Teller, Chief Steppenwolf, who stood on guard with warheads and strategies of overkill, bomb now, pay later. And good night, blind flight of black avenging angels, bow marks of death zeroed on infinity. And good night, great mute poets and professors who only stand and wait. And good night, Papa Hemingway, who also finked out. And good night, Grandpa Ezra. And good night, Reverend Elliot, who also fabricated and abdicated. Hurry up, please, it's time. And good night, stream of unconscious novelists and non-objecting painters. Thou shalt not kill except by complicity. And good day, Dylan. We shall not go gentle into their good night. And good day, Neruda, and good day, Ginsburg, who saw the great heads draw back weeping from their plots. And good day, Fidel. He doesn't want to marry your sister. He just wants to socialize. And good night, sweet dreams, crazy Karl Marx. I, too, wish the state would wither away into a world without countries and their great draggy nationalisms. And their great draggy governments, which aren't our idea of communities of love. So good night, old, old comrades. The good old days are gone forever. So goodbye, goodbye, death. And good morning, sun. And goodbye, senators. And good morning, heart that wakes at night and hears itself. And good morning, crocus voices. And good morning, water birds, cawing and cawing. And good morning, lovers, south of 14th Street, about to turn off the whole evil scene and turn on beautiful and great, where the air is green.
So this concludes our this week's edition of Drama Text. Tonight we heard selections of the work of Lawrence Ferlinghetti, San Francisco poet who passed away at the age of 101 last week. You're listening, of course, to CKUT 90.3 on the FM dial. We're coming up to 9 p.m. We'll be back next week at 8 p.m. for another hour-long presentation of the spoken word.
Ring, 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 CKUT.
Yeah.
Ding, dong, ding, dong, ding, dong, ding, CKUT. 90.3, take it from me. It's the best, beats the rest. 90.3 CKUT.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT, we're on the air. I'm the I, fly, CKUT. CKUT.
mais ça va pas tarder.
Et tu l'as pris pour quoi?
J'ai pris le vaccin danse.
Le vaccin danse? Trop bonne idée.
Ouais, m'entraîner avec les filles, c'est ce qui me manque le plus.
Ben moi, le mien, ça va être le vaccin soccer. Je suis vraiment impatiente de retrouver toute la gang.
La vaccination nous rapproche de tous ces moments. Suivez la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prenez rendez-vous à québec.ca/vaccin-COVID. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Vous écoutez Chaud pour le Monstone sur les ondes de CKUT 90.3 FM.